Good morning. It's Monday, October 21st. I'm Shamitha Basu. This is Apple News Today. On today's show, the crime that has spiked in the D.C. area. An American citizen speaks out about spending years in a Russian prison. And the surprising class of new millionaires. But first, Election Day is just 2 weeks away, but thanks to early voting, people have begun casting ballots in a majority of states. As of this weekend, more than 14 million people have voted, according to the University of Florida's Election Lab, which keeps a tally on this. Turnout is so high that early voting records have been broken in critical battleground states, including in Georgia and North Carolina. At the same time, there have already been dozens of lawsuits filed contesting voting protocols. Joining me to talk about what all of this means is my colleague, Gideon Resnick. Hey, Gideon.
Hey, Shamita.
So let's talk about these huge early voting numbers that we are seeing. What do the numbers tell us so far about who is winning or who is losing this election?
Well, not to be a wet blanket about it, but the short answer is it doesn't tell us much, honestly. So you might see all over your social media people making claims about, you know, oh, this many people voted in a particular Democratic stronghold, and that must mean that Democrats will win the state, or this many Republicans voted in this stronghold, and that means Republicans are going to win the state. But, you know, say, for example, we look at one of these states, I don't know, Georgia, and we look at Fulton County, and we say that a Democrat voted there. Is that good for Democrats? Maybe if that Democrat voted for the Democratic candidates, but we don't know that. You know, these ballots get cast ahead of time, but they don't get tallied ahead of time. And secondly, if we even look at all of these numbers, we're only seeing a sliver of the overall eventual turnout. I think Jeffrey Skelly, a senior elections analyst at 538, put it well.
We can see in states that have party registration, like what percentage are Democrats, what percentage are Republicans, what percentage are independents. And that's helpful. But the problem is that doesn't mean that we know how many people are going to actually show up on election day.
So that's just to say, we don't know if early voting numbers capture people who would have voted anyway later on election day itself, or if those are in addition to those people.
Okay, so I get that, but I thought that conventional wisdom told us that early voting and mail-in ballots benefit Democrats more, right?
That's definitely the case, particularly in recent elections. Democrats have been far more likely to vote early and to vote by mail. For example, in 2020, about 60% of Democrats voted by mail versus 32% of Republicans. That's according to a study by the MIT Election Data and Science Lab. But there are a couple things to say here as we consider that, right? So one is that it kind of underscores the main point that we're making. If a large majority of Republicans are not voting by mail, or they're not necessarily voting early and they're waiting until election day, then early voting overall kind of doesn't tell us that much. And secondly, the disparity is more of a recent trend, because as you remember, in 2020, former President Trump was really criticizing early voting and mail-in voting as a way to falsely suggest there's fraud in elections. And actually this year, there's been a big Republican effort to counter that and to try to get their voters to show up. Mm-hmm. And then the last thing when we talk about 2020 versus 2024 is it's kind of hard to draw comparisons to how this all broke down, because the pandemic led to a massive uptick in absentee and mail-in voting. We had never tried to conduct an election in that particular circumstance. So
sure.
Is this year going to follow a similar pattern, or are we going to see way more election day voting? We just don't really know yet.
Okay. So in addition to early voting, we're also seeing a lot of early lawsuits. What are in these suits? Who are they coming from, and where could they go?
Yeah, there are quite a lot. In fact, Bloomberg tallied it and said that there are at least 165 lawsuits that have been filed since 2023. And really, they cover all sorts of things, challenging all facets of the election, everything from ballot drop boxes in certain states to voter ID options for college students and others. Now, a majority of them have been filed by Republicans and conservative allies. There are some that are also coming from Democrats. The Republican ones are largely a downstream effect of what we had just talked about, that, you know, former President Trump has consistently made these false claims of fraud in the past election. Mm-hmm. Bloomberg also notes that many of these suits have been filed quite recently, which means they're not likely to be resolved by November, but the purpose might be to sow distrust in the process. And we're seeing some judges already in various states push back against some of these efforts. Recently, for example, a judge in Georgia invalidated a lot of these rules that had recently passed by this Republican-led election board. One of those rules would have basically allowed them to potentially delay certification results. The other thing here, too, is that this is the first presidential election after federal legislation that was basically meant to prevent certification delays and ensure that something like January 6th never happens again. So the system may indeed get tested this time, but there are some new measures in place.
And we'll keep watching to see how it unfolds. Gideon, thank you so much.
Of course, thank you.
And if you would like to know more about early voting options available to you in your state, Apple News has a guide that we made in partnership with NBC. You can find that in the Election 2024 section of the Apple News app. Let's turn now to the Middle East, where things are moving quickly as Israel fights wars on multiple fronts. First, there are renewed calls for Israel and Hamas to return to the negotiating table after Israel took out its number one target last week, Hamas's leader, Yahya Sinwar. Over the weekend, an Israeli air attack in the northern Gaza Strip hit several houses and a multi-story residential building, killing at least 87 people, with many others trapped under the rubble. Here's one young girl talking with Al Jazeera after the attack.
I was in the market, came home to find all my brothers and sisters gone. All of them were killed, ripped to pieces, their flesh scattered all over the place.
Rescue efforts have been difficult because for weeks now, there's been a near blackout on communications. There's also been little to no access to food, water, medicine, or other essential services. Meanwhile, tensions are escalating between Israel and Iran. On Saturday, a Hezbollah drone penetrated Israel's air defenses and exploded in close proximity to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's private home. Neither he nor his wife were home at the time, and no injuries were reported. Israeli officials have been meeting for weeks to plan an attack against Iran after Iran fired a series of ballistic missiles at Israel earlier this month. Israel's foreign minister said over the weekend that the attack near Netanyahu's home was another crossing of a red line by Iran. Iran denies involvement in the attack and has warned that if Israel strikes, Iran is prepared to fight back even harder. Also this weekend, there was an apparent leak of Pentagon documents that detailed some of Israel's preparations for an upcoming attack on Iran. House Speaker Mike Johnson told CNN's State of the Union on Sunday that an investigation is underway into the leak, which has not yet been verified, and that he supports Israel's decision to go after Iran.
And I think we're very close, I hope, I pray, to ending that conflict there. But we cannot equivocate. We can't appease Iran. Now is the time for a maximum pressure campaign against the head of the snake. It's not Hezbollah and Hamas and the proxies that are ultimately the threat. It is Iran itself. And I think we need to recognize that reality right now.
This all comes as Israel is fighting a third front in the war as well, against Hezbollah in Lebanon. Israel conducted a wave of airstrikes across Lebanon over the weekend, targeting financial offices associated with Hezbollah in an apparent attempt to disrupt the group's day-to-day operations and undermine its support in Lebanese communities. Now to a story about a very particular type of crime in and around our nation's capital. One night, Shantice Summers was walking toward her apartment in her neighborhood in Maryland when she was accosted by strangers.
She's almost to her door when she is approached by several masked juveniles who have a gun, stick it in her face, and demand the keys to her 2019 Honda Accord.
That's Jamie Thompson, a contributing writer with The Atlantic.
She hands over her keys and the juveniles make off with her car, her phone, you know, everything that's in her car. And she sort of runs into the house, traumatized and terrified, crying and shaking, and calls the police department. She now suddenly has no car, so she has no way to get her kids to school, the doctor. She doesn't have a way to get herself to her job at the post office. So it begins to sort of create this real financial burden in her life. It really has these ripple effects in her life, both emotionally and financially, for months.
And Chantisa's experience wasn't isolated. Last year alone, there were 958 reported carjackings in D.C. In some cases, the perpetrators are just kids as young as 12 years old. In recent years, some of the victims were high-profile people, including a congressman from Texas, a chief of staff for the Commodity Futures Trading Commission who was killed in a carjacking. Even police have been victims of it. About 70% of cases go unsolved. In Chantisa's case, police caught the suspects the same day, but
one of the kids was found involved for having done the carjacking, but is released that day. So the person who violently carjacked her walks out of court right in front of her. And she's sort of outraged at this happening, just that this sort of seemingly just utter lack of consequences for this very traumatic thing that has happened to her. And it seems to really be going unpunished.
So why is this happening? Well, a lot of it started during the pandemic,
which turned so many of our institutions upside down. You had protracted school closings, you had a lack of recreation centers, a lapse in social services. So you had a lot of kids on the streets without much to do.
This was also happening as the country was reacting to the murder of George Floyd in 2020. And many people began looking at the politics of policing more critically. Tough-on-crime policies had disproportionately affected poor Black communities.
Policing in America is sort of undergoing an existential crisis of its own. You have a climate where cops are really telling us that they become hesitant to do anything that they would call proactive in the realm of policing.
Recently, things have gotten a bit better. Carjackings in D.C. are down more than 50% this year, and by about a quarter in the Maryland county where Chantisa's car was stolen. Police say it's because they're getting better at solving cases and because public sentiment has shifted back toward harsher policing and prosecution. But experts warn that strategy doesn't address societal issues at the root of this. Statistics show many of the teens involved in D.C.'s juvenile justice system are experiencing homelessness, neglect, or abuse, and behavioral issues. As one person who used to work under the Attorney General's office for D.C. told The Atlantic, two things are true at the same time here. Carjacking is a terrible crime, and a child who commits a crime like this has likely been failed in so many ways. Before we let you go, a few other stories being featured in the Apple News app. Millions of people in Cuba were without power for the third day in a row on Sunday due to a major power grid collapse. This comes after months of rolling blackouts and as Cuba is experiencing a dire economic crisis, which started during the pandemic when tourism collapsed and then President Donald Trump issued sanctions against the island nation. Since then, inflation has soared, the economy has tanked, and there are widespread food shortages. NPR reports that it's gotten so bad that earlier this year, the Cuban government only allocated bread to children and pregnant women. Cuba's prime minister attributed the blackouts to the country's deteriorating infrastructure and fuel shortages, both of which he says were exacerbated by Hurricane Milton 2 weeks ago. Paul Whelan, the American Marine veteran who was wrongfully detained in Russia for nearly 6 years until this past summer when he was freed in a prisoner swap, is speaking out about what it was like. He told CBS's Face the Nation, prison guards tortured him with sleep deprivation.
They would come every 2 hours to my bed at night and they would wake me up. They'd shine a light in my face and take a picture. Getting off that sleep pattern has been very, very difficult. So now, you know, I'm sleeping better than I was, but it is still tremendously difficult to sleep for 6 or 8 hours at a time.
After years of watching other prisoner swap deals being made without him, Whelan said it was emotional to finally be on a plane heading home.
I knew we were getting close to England. And as we got closer, I saw the White Cliffs of Dover. So I knew that once we were in, friendly British airspace, we would then go to Irish. We'd soon be in Canadian airspace and then be in America.
And the Wall Street Journal has reporting on a big transformation happening in trades like plumbing, electrical, and HVAC. These were the kinds of jobs that traditionally were mom-and-pop owned and handed down to the next generation. But lately, they're being bought up by private equity firms that believe they can turn them into bigger, more profitable operations. This wave of investment is, in the Journal's words, minting a new class of millionaires across the country. You can find all these stories and more in the Apple News app. And if you're already listening in the news app right now, we've got that Atlantic article about carjackings queued up to play for you next. If you're listening in the podcast app, follow Apple News Plus Narrated to find that story. And I'll be back with the news tomorrow.